This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening. The Muslim holiday feast of Eid al-Adha begins on Thursday. It's also called Eid al-Kabir, the big holiday. This is the big one. Well, would the government troops and rebels in Syria stop killing each other long enough for the children, the vulnerable children in Syria, to enjoy the festivities, all the traditional barbecued meats of Eid al-Adha, the wheat porridge breakfast with a little liver on the side? That's traditional. The kids often leave the liver for mom and dad and focus on the traditional sweets, though. But will there be peace, even for just a few hours, for the feast of Eid al-Adha? UN and Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi is saying that the Syrian government has agreed to a ceasefire. Mr. Brahimi, speaking in Egypt through a translator, delivered this tentative announcement yesterday, which sounded more like the rumor of peace, not a peace agreement.
Following my recent visit to Damascus, I would like to tell you that the Syrian government has agreed to a ceasefire during the Eid period. I believe they will issue a statement to this effect either today or tomorrow. We contacted other sites inside Syria and leaders of the fighting groups. Most of them had also accepted to observe a ceasefire. If this modest initiative succeeds, we hope to build on it and aim for a lasting and solid ceasefire.
Certainly something to hope for there. Mr. Lakhdar Brahimi speaking in Egypt. He's the UN envoy for Syria. The last ceasefire, put together by envoy Kofi Annan, collapsed soon after it was announced, both sides claiming the other had broken it. Our next guest has recently returned from a reporting trip inside Syria. C.J. Chivers is a correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He regularly writes for the Times At War blog. He joins us today from Rhode Island. C.J., welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, John.
So, first of all, try to put us into the mind of families who are thinking about this holiday period. Muslim families are you know, typically go through extraordinary sacrifice to get the meat on the table that this feast is all about. And in Damascus, it's usually a very, very, very lavish affair, but not so this year.
Well, I would think that as the war has been continuing, you know, you're entering your second winter here, and there is a deep fatigue of this war and something like a hopelessness that something like a ceasefire or peace can be made or can hold. So I would think that the families there would welcome the respite, but it doesn't really frame a solution here.
And indeed, each family will be on their own trying to determine if they even have access to the facilities, the food, in places like Aleppo, of course, that are in the middle of very severe violence, Damascus, not so much. So, C.J. Chivers, what I'd like to do is play some of your reporting that you have filed on the New York Times website on various stories that you've observed inside Syria during this latest trip. First of all, let's listen to this video clip from your reporting, and then we'll talk about it.
The Syrian military has escalated its use of force throughout the war, now in its 19th month, trying to contain an expanding and increasingly lethal insurgency challenging a government that once was supreme. Interviews in Syria, as well as the examination of shattered rifles and the contents of a booby-trapped cartridge, uncover one of the government's tactics, surreptitiously distributing so-called hot ammunition.
Now, what are you talking about there? There's booby-trapped weapons and ammunition being distributed. Essentially, the rebels' own weapons are being used against them?
Well, in this case, what's being done is that replicas, if you will, of working ammunition are being made that explode when fired. And then this ammunition is seeded into the rebel supply sources, either to the black markets or it's left behind when army units withdraw from positions or kicked off the back of a passing truck. And then it finds its way into the rebels' possession, into the rebels' weapons, where from there it explodes when used.
And it's of almost no tactical or strategic significance in the sense that you don't win battles with these kinds of tactics, but you do deny the rebels their ability to recruit?
Well, I wouldn't say it so much works against recruitment. It works against the mind of the rebels in terms of not trusting their supply sources or not trusting their weapons. And it does, in fact, if it's a wide-scale program and it's not detected right away, it can lead to significant numbers of casualties. It was interesting in that of about the six fighting groups I talked to, all of them said they had suffered some losses to this.
And what kinds of injuries are we talking about here? And what are the long-term implications?
Well, they vary from, you know, broken hands and burned hands to, you know, a mangled lowered limb to something that's much more severe, including, you know, if the explosive charge is large enough and the person firing the rifle is unlucky enough, you can get a big piece of the rifle in the head or chest, and that can be fatal.
Now, C.J. Chivers, in thinking about this story yesterday, and I looked on the website at all of the really amazing characters and pictures that you filed for The New York Times. I mean, if you are going to pick up a weapon in a conflict like Syria, you have to have an expectation that one way or another you could be injured or killed. Does it matter that much that a booby-trapped weapon might be the reason for a casualty in this particular case?
Well, you raise an interesting point. It gets to the question of how discriminate such a tactic is. And you're right. If these weapons are being used by combatants, then the program is being narrowly targeted and you could argue successful. The problem with these sorts of programs is that you can't contain where ammunition flows after its initial distribution. And what you see again and again in the Middle East and elsewhere is that ammunition moves almost liquidly around a region, and it lasts longer than the conflicts to which it was brought. So this ammunition could turn up in any numbers of places or uses in the future, from a shepherd who's trying to, cull a pest animal to a farmer. Or a property owner who owns a weapon for self-defense. So when you start using rifle cartridges, rifles are fundamentally dual-use items. They're not just for war. And so a program like this isn't necessarily going to be contained to targeting just combatants.
Booby-trapped weapons and ammunition, one of the disheartening and brutal details of the conflict in Syria. We're speaking with C.J. Chivers, correspondent with our partner, The New York Times, who's recently returned from a reporting trip to Syria. This is The Takeaway. So, CJ, you describe some history of this tactic being used. It certainly wasn't invented by the Syrian government or whoever is making it a brutal reality there in Damascus and Aleppo. It goes back a ways.
It's certainly not a Syrian tactic per se. You can trace this back perhaps a century or more. It was used by the British in the Black and Tan War against the Irish way back in the early Troubles. And it's been used many, many times since. I've had readers tell me from the Russian-speaking world that it was used in Central Asia against the Islamic uprising in the 1920s. It was used in World War II. And the United States government has used and continues to use the same tactic. There was an extensive program in Vietnam against the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong, and there was a program in Iraq and a similar one that's ongoing in Afghanistan.
In your reporting in Syria, you met members of the militia and the rebels who, you know, are banded together in a very loosely organized group of often, neighborhood-driven rebel groups, some with religious affiliation, some with just being affiliated with their city being under siege. What's the sense of morale and the expectation that these people might actually win this conflict?
Well, I think that the morale is up and down because war is an up and down affair, and some days are much worse than others. I would say that there's a very strong sense of purpose and ultimately a sense of confidence. I believe that the rebels think that the demographics are on their side and that the momentum is on their side and that they will eventually unravel this government. But the morale itself is a more troubling thing because many days the rebels are angry, frustrated, dismayed that they don't have support and that it's going slowly as you would expect it would.
And who can you introduce me to from your reporting who represents either a very articulate spokesman for the rebels who convinces you that this cause actually could in the end produce victory, or someone who strikes you as extraordinarily courageous?
Well, you know, I would talk about one of the more recent characters in this case would be a gentleman who uses the name Abu Azab, and he runs a fighting group. He claims to have 200 fighters. He probably has fewer than that. But it's a fighting group called Voices of the Right Brigade, and they're in what passes for the mountains of Syria in the Jabal al-Zawiya region. And they began with virtually nothing, you know, a few hunting rifles, a few shotguns, and have gradually, checkpoint by checkpoint, cleared almost all of the mountains. There's a few strong points remaining. And I think that their own experience in this war tells them, and Abu Azab will tell you, that the direction that this points to is that the army cannot stay and at least cannot operate effectively where it's not wanted. And when you listen to Abu Azab, what you hear, you know, at one point we were strolling with him through a cemetery where his own nephew is buried and where he's dug his own grave, and he's ready to be put into that grave, as are any of number of people who are around him. When you listen to gentlemen like this, you don't see that they are going to stop. You don't see that a ceasefire is going to hold. I mean, this war may have turned a corner. And then when you look at the demographics of Syria, with its weight towards the Sunni population, you have to think that this is probably going to end only in one way, with the government falling at some point. If that's the case, then the question is what it looks like afterward.
And questions to be asked the next time you go into Syria. You'll be back, yes?
Yeah, I'll be back, I hope, within a couple of weeks.
C.J. Chivers, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, who's just returned from a reporting trip to Syria. C.J., as always, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.